Hi, my name is Ron Hogan, and you're listening to Life Stories, a new podcast series that I've launched through my book website, Beatrice.com. Life Stories is about memoirs. I'll be talking to memoir writers about their lives and about the art of writing memoirs about those lives. And my first guest is Heather Donahue. You might recognize her from the Blair Witch Project, but a few years back, when her acting career was gravitating towards its natural end, she ended up making a big life change, which she talks about in Grow Girl. And I was lucky enough to have a chance to talk to her about that book. So here is that conversation. At the beginning of Grow Girl, you talk a little bit about how you had reached this stage in your acting career where kind of the momentum of having been, you know, the girl from the Blair Witch Project had run its course, and you really kind of had to step back and take a real hard look at what was going to be the future of your acting career, and what was that moment like for you?
Well, that moment specifically happened while I was shooting a movie called The Morgue, and I was laying on wet asphalt with rubber tubing draped across my face and apple juice dribbling down my cheek, having just simulated death by mock fellatio. So I was looking up at the sky and this camera and being in this movie that I really wouldn't have ever watched, and thought to myself, maybe this acting thing really isn't working out. And it was a little hard because that's what I trained for. That was what I went to conservatory for. So it became sort of a part of my identity, because when you're going to conservatory and you're doing the BFA program, they tell you, if you think you can be anything else, you should totally be that. And so they encourage you almost to take it on as who you are. I am an actor, and there's nothing else I can do. If I had something to fall back on, I would simply fall. And so I went forth with as much courage as I could muster, and I'm very proud of my acting career, actually. I'm really proud of the work I did. And I'm also really proud that I moved on when I did.
And I mean, you were in this really interesting moment as an actor, because the part that you were most identified for, I mean, you were playing, and I'm using air quotes here, you know, you were playing yourself, and you were sort of seen by the world as in a more sort of in a documentary fashion, rather than playing a part.
Right. We were definitely told that we weren't acting repeatedly, which was also hard to take. But at the same time, you know, Blair Witch has this weird position in my life, because it's neither good nor bad. It's just big. It's just this big, strange thing that happened.
And once you sort of made that appraisal of where your life was going, you write about, and you really made a clean break, or at least attempted to make a clean break in whatever it was that you were going to do next.
Well, I knew I wanted to really empty my cup. I wanted to let go of everything that wasn't working for me anymore. And so I took it all and put it in the back of my car, drove out to the desert and burned it. And for me, that was the beginning of my new life. And I had no idea what that new life was going to consist of at that time. I just knew it was going to be completely different.
And soon enough, you found that found out where your new life was going. Tell me about the sequence of events that sort of like led you to Nugget Town.
Well, after I burned everything in the desert in what I call the Great Purge, I went to a meditation retreat. I have a long-standing Vipassana meditation practice. And on the last day of that retreat, this guy came up to me, sat down next to me, invited me to a hot springs, and then I asked him where he was from, and he said Nugget Town. Well, he didn't say Nugget Town. That's a name I've made up to keep the town protected. And I said, God, what do you do up there? Because I had been there, and I'd fallen in love with this place. It's a beautiful little town. But I couldn't figure out what people did for work up there. And he said, well, I grow pot. And I thought to myself, well, ding, ding, ding. Like, I want to see how that works. Like, I would love to be able to have the time to write, to have the time to sit and think, you know. And I wasn't really able to have that in Los Angeles. And it was something that meant a lot to me to be able to kind of have that time. And for me, my time as a pot grower was almost like my independent study MFA. But instead of weaving with a mountain of debt, I left with a book.
So was writing something that had interested you, you know, even during the acting career, was that a...
Well, I came to acting from writing when I was a little girl. I could read when I was two. I was kind of a weird kid. So I was reading and writing from the time I was really, really small. But there weren't really books in my house. I don't really come from a family of readers, so acting sort of made more sense. It was a thing that my family could kind of relate to more, so that's what I got praised for more. And I think that's why I ended up kind of following that path. I think kids will generally go in the direction in which they're praised, right? So for me, it was Blair Witch is a blessing because it got me back to where I really wanted to be. This feels so much better to me. It feels great to have those long periods of solitude, and it makes this part of it a lot more fun for me because it's not a constantly public thing. It's such a private thing, and then that you then get to share with people.
And so, in terms of what you were saying about, you know, this pot farming giving you like sort of this room for your MFA program.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, how did that work? Because it seems, you know, in reading Grow Girl, that it feels like you were taking good notes the whole time, that you were, or at least, you know, very observational the whole time.
I was writing every day. It was a great life. My entire life all of a sudden opened wide up. And yeah, there were downsides, like the paranoia, for example, dealing with the community, having my parents be worried. That was a real problem for me. But God, to be able to walk the dog by the river on a Tuesday afternoon and come home and write and then tend the girls in the evening, the girls were my marijuana plants. In some ways, I think, oh my God, what have I done leaving it to write about? Like, couldn't I have just written some novel instead? Why did I have to give that up? It was a pretty sweet gig.
And, you know, talking about the girls, you know, there's a whole, very labor-intensive routine around the girls. I mean, yeah, growing marijuana turns out not to be this sort of like, you know, idyllic agrarian fantasy. It's very hard work.
Well, most agrarian things are and do end up being rather hard work. And I think that's what people fail to understand about it. It is really a rather wholesome farming job to a large extent. Of course, I was doing indoor growing, so that's a little more technologically complicated. I had to learn how to set up the CO2 tanks, the regulators, the fans, the air cooling, it's a wonderful, challenging, and interesting job. And I wasn't prepared for how much I was going to fall in love with it. It was incredibly satisfying. Like, when you first flip the girls, like, so you veg them for a while.
Mm-hmm.
They're in this vegetative stage. After you've cloned them and they've rooted, then they veg for a few weeks. And then once they're done vegging, it's time to flip them into flower. So you put them on this 12-12 lighting schedule to mimic the onset of fall, the light during fall. And when you first put them in that bloom room, you'll go in when the lights come back on, and they've grown 2 inches a night. And it's sort of awe-inspiring. You're like, wow, this plant is incredibly strong, not just in its medicine, but just in its... It's just such a force of nature, you know?
Right, and medicine is something that we should very much emphasize here and get out right on the table, is mm-hmm. that... You were growing in full compliance with California's
medical
marijuana laws.
Yes, I was. Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I was. It is legal in California, and a lot of people have taken advantage of it in this difficult economy. It's been a real harbor for a lot of people, and particularly for a lot of Northern California small towns.
In fact, you kind of hit on this in Grow Girl about halfway through, where you suggest that... you know, Nugget Town in particular,
mm-hmm.
Seems to rely very strongly on the pot economy
mm-hmm.
in ways that may, should the economic circumstances change.
The economic circumstances did change.
Mm-hmm.
After Obama's statement that he wasn't going to prosecute anybody in compliance with state law, the price dropped by about 50% over those 3 years.
Mm-hmm.
And then this fall, in October, the DEA stepped in again and started raiding dispensaries, which had the almost instantaneous effect of getting the price back up. So I can't help but wonder if the resistance to legalization is more of a business problem than a public health problem.
Right, and you'd hit upon the fact that because the financial assets were quite frequently seizable, that nobody kept any cash on hand, that it's like if the cash came in, they bought things. And so like a lot of the, you know, the higher-end retail outlets in Nugget Town generated a lot of revenue and a lot of sales tax based on pot growers, you know, just looking to offload, you know, to offload, and, or, you know, if it were less of a quasi-legal standpoint, you know, we would even say that they were laundering the money.
No, I would definitely not say that. Okay. This is really people just having fun with their cash. It really, I would not, definitely not call that laundering. I think having cash on hand and buying a kayak is, you know, toy accumulation.
Fair enough.
Or sending, you know, a lot of people beyond even the toy consumption were sending their kids to a better private school or, you know, keeping, actually in this economy, it was more like just keeping their house, you know, or a granny whose pension isn't quite cutting it, being able to have a little bit of a better life. She's already growing roses. Why not throw a few ganja plants in there? She's already got a green thumb.
And as long as all the paperwork is in order, it's okay.
Exactly.
Although you write about how those first couple of weeks and months were very edgy for you, in part because you didn't necessarily have all the paperwork in order right away.
It took a while to get all that together, yeah. It was a nail-biter, certainly early on. It took a long time to get used to this sort of chronic low-grade anxiety that came with growing. But then the ultimate result of that was that I realized I could only get so afraid. You know, I could only get so paranoid. At a certain point, the solitude of my cabin in the woods gave me the time to sit with that fear and let it grow until it hit its own critical mass and collapsed on itself, which has had the sort of lasting result of making me fairly fearless. So when people ask, yes, what, are you crazy to write a memoir about something that's federally legal? I think it's time to have this conversation about the policy surrounding cannabis. I think it's ridiculous, and prohibition tears families apart way more than the plant ever possibly could. And so I figured, well, I mean, what do I really have to lose? You know, I'm a single woman with a dog. I'm a good candidate to participate in this because I believe in it, I care about it, and it changed the course of my life in a way that I'll always be really grateful for.
And one of the ways that your life was changing through all this, and you talk about this a lot in the memoir, is that, you know, we've talked about it being a very sort of like technical and field with a lot of core competencies required. And as a woman attempting to become an individual grower, you are entering into a field where you know, your initial consultants were primarily male growers who, for all of Nugget Town's community vibe, there is a lot of competitiveness and sort of like that male sort of like approach to accomplishment about growing.
Well, and I think also because it's difficult to share those accomplishments outside of the community, that competition within the community does become a little more fierce. And also the community doesn't exist in a vacuum, right? So you still have the greater socioeconomic picture pressing down on this smaller town. So as good as the intentions were, and the intentions were very, very good in the community, it really was about how can we sustain ourselves? Can we grow our own food? Can we raise chickens? Can we be good to our kids and be able to spend time with them, you know, and not live this rushed lifestyle, but something that's more open and at ease. And we all did largely accomplish that, despite the pressures from the outside in terms of the legality.
Right. And for you, there's an additional pressure in terms of, you know, wanting to do this on your own, to make it on your own, to actually go out and accomplish this thing rather than sort of, you know, take the fallback position of becoming like
a pot wife.
Mm-hmm.
No, I was never in any danger of becoming a pot wife, but I did have a little pot wife envy after about a year as a grower. It seemed, their lives seemed comforting to me. It seemed like they were very at ease in this sort of pursuit of a biological imperative that I felt, and I sort of felt like my urge toward independence didn't always serve me. Sometimes I felt kind of tricked by feminism. Like, God, wouldn't it be nice to just cook a dinner and have a baby in a bathtub and call it a day, you know? Like, part of me really envied the pot wives, their capacity to feel like that was enough. Because for me, it felt dangerous to me because I didn't see any 40-year-old pot wives and I was already 34 at that time. So I felt like I had to do it on my own. Like I didn't really have the luxury of becoming a pot wife. And then the strangest thing happened. My first round of girls hermied, which means they also produced not just female flowers, but also male flowers, which is something that happens to the plants under stress. And I couldn't help but see the metaphor in that because that's almost what I felt had happened to me. Like, I had become capable enough to be everything to myself and in the process forgot how to need in a certain way. I was independent to the point of almost isolation, or was actually quite literally isolation in my house at the end of the road.
And as you're going through this process and you're writing this all this down every day,
mm-hmm.
At what point did you feel like that there was something here that you were ready to share as a writer with the outside world?
I at first thought that I was going to write a memoir in the City Mouse, Country Mouse vein.
Mm-hmm.
The paranoia around being a grower is so entrenched in me at that point. I didn't even type the word pot onto my laptop until 6 months into writing this draft. So, into writing the book. So it definitely required a leap of faith at a certain point that I was going to go ahead and do this and take this risk, because it was and is really a rather a large risk. I knew that the members of the community wouldn't be too excited about it. I knew that it could bring me problems. I was worried about it, for sure.
Right.
It was a lot of cause for alarm.
In fact, you write, there's a note here at the very beginning, that you say, I've sort of composited characters, altered timelines, nudged the odd fact, basically changed all proper nouns except for yours and the name of your dogs,
right.
And kind of really gone out of your way to make Nugget Town, which, mm-hmm. as we've established, is not the name of Nugget Town,
mm-hmm.
To really sort of make it impossible for people to, you know, find Nugget Town, let's say.
Well, I think when you write a memoir, there are a lot of moral quandaries that you come up against. I had to make those moral decisions at every turn, really. Was I going to include the fact that Judah had a child? For a while, I had taken that out. Because I wanted to absolutely mitigate any kind of risk to him and his daughter. But at the end, I put her back in because it just didn't make sense without her. She was such a part of what I fell in love with. It was Judah, it was the town, it was his daughter. It was this life that was so much more expansive than what my life in LA had become by the end. And it felt so good to be a part of that. It felt like home from the first time I went there.
And what was it like to to shape that experience, which, you know, as you said, you've been drafting all along, mm-hmm. to shape that into a coherent story.
Well, I was more journaling, so I wasn't real. I was definitely not thinking that this was going to be the book I was writing. So, when it came time to shape it, I did it actually in quite a classical way. I used, you know, Sid Field's screenplay paradigm, whereas I really tried to think about where's plot point one, where's my midpoint, because I think it's very hard to shape memoir, because it's very hard to step outside of the events and see what's really important, because what's really important to you isn't going to necessarily be what's important to the reader. So I had to kind of step back and think, God, how do I get beyond anecdote and understand what the story is here? I see I have a ton of situations, just sort of quote Vivian Gornick. She has this wonderful book, The Situation and the Story, which I rely on in the classes that I teach and as I was writing this book. How do I get beyond the situation and find what it is that's really going to resonate with a reader? What's universal about my story? Where can I dig in so deep into my own experience that I'm going to hit that basic human core that we all share? And I hope I did that, because I really... That was one of my main objectives.
Yeah, I think it's really important for anyone who wants to try and write a memoir about their lives to realize, like, as you say, it's not just a sequence of events.
No.
That there really does need to be this sort of identification of, you know, structure is part of it, but I think, you know, there is this identification of a narrative to it, with a beginning, a mm-hmm. middle, and an end, and a through line. Mm-hmm. You know, an actual through line where the events that you're describing matter, that they have significance and impact as they happen.
For me, mm-hmm. the book is about identity and growing up. Mm-hmm. And I think we don't really encourage ourselves to grow up in this culture. And so it takes a little bit of a leap of faith to say, oh, yes, growing up could possibly be quite satisfying. You know? So for me, it's almost like the pot growing is almost incidental. It more functions as the central metaphor than anything else. Although you could figure out a fair amount of how to from reading Grow Girl.
And certainly Grow Girl does provide references to the places where you would.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Yeah. But, growing also allowed me the time to become a hospice volunteer. It allowed me the time to train my dog really well. It gave me the time to raise some chickens. It gave me the time to really have time for people. If there was a dog on the side of the road, I had the time to give him a lift. It was those kinds of things that really mattered to me. Mm-hmm. And those are the things that I really, really miss now. Being able to just, like, call up a friend and go for a hike by the irrigation ditch, you know, like... We're doing something wrong, I think, when we don't have those moments, when we don't have that little extra bit of space in our lives for those things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it sounds like for all that, you talk about your parents coming to visit and how they were very concerned about how you were throwing your life away. I'm exaggerating.
They're also pretty proud of me. It's no small thing to build a grow room.
Right. Eventually they came around. But initially, let's say there was some
very
real concern.
My dad was resistant, for sure. And they were worried about my safety really more than anything mm-hmm. else. They were really concerned about my safety.
But it sounds like, and certainly the way you talk about it, your mother is already picking this up while she comes to visit, but certainly by the end of the story, it is very evident that you are becoming that this experience has enabled you to become a person that they can look at unreservedly, mm-hmm. you know, even to the, you know, beyond the fact that parents do look at us mm-hmm. unreservedly, but to say, like, you know, I'm proud of how you turned out.
Yeah. I think they're proud of my fearlessness. Mm-hmm. And I think they're proud that I took the lessons of hard work that they taught me and industriousness, but I have certainly made them my own.
And now that you have the memoir and you're sort of coming out into the world again, mm-hmm. What is sort of next on your writing plate?
I have a novel that I'm working on, and I have two nonfiction books that I'm trying to clarify in my mind exactly what they should look like. Mm-hmm. So I'll be working on the proposals for them as soon as I finish with the book, the novel book.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's definitely the case that writing is your direction?
I finally got back to the originary point. I remember winning my first writing contest when I was a very little girl about how I became one of Olivia Newton-John's sisters in Xanadu. And it was this rather fully realized little story about roller skating and rainbows and tap dancing. But that capacity to just be inside my own head and have it actually mean something to anybody else feels amazing to me, because otherwise I'm just going to be in my head for no good reason. So it's really nice to be able to share that and not just collapse under the weight of my own solipsism, which, you know, is never good.
Cool. Well, we're definitely looking forward to seeing what the fiction turns out like.
It should be fun. Similar themes in the fiction.
Cool. Well, thanks again for participating in the conversation, and again, take care.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to Life Stories. That was Heather Donahue. Again, my name is Ron Hogan, and you'll be able to listen to Life Stories through my website, Beatrice.com, and pretty soon on iTunes. In fact, you may already be listening to this on iTunes, I hope. Our next conversation will be with the musician Storm Large, and I hope you'll keep an eye out for that when it goes up online. Thanks again. Bye-bye.